year is 391. The place, Eleusis, a small city northwest of Athens, Greece. Crowded into the Telesterion, an underground amphitheater, a group of initiates waits in the blackness for the great mystery to begin. The darkness brings fear and awe. For each initiate, it's the culmination of a spiritual odyssey that began more than a year earlier. Earlier today, each has walked the sacred way from Athens, 14 sun-drenched miles, offering prayers to Demeter, the goddess of fertility. They've drunk Kaikion, the sacred brew whose psychoactive effects are coming on strong. They await the ecstasy of illumination. On a signal, fire lights the darkness and sends shadows flickering. The initiates start to dance and will emerge in the morning changed men and women. No longer fearing death, they're immortal. No person today can say for certain what happened in the Telesterion. The Eleusinian Mysteries, among the most ancient and prestigious of the Greco-Roman world, guarded secrets on pain of death, and the initiates kept quiet, which says something about what they experienced. But the great mysteries of 391 would be the last. The Christian Emperor Theodosius closed the shrine and banned its rituals. 4 years later, marauding Visigoths sacked and burned Eleusis, leaving it a pile of rubble. The secret society, which had endured for almost 2,000 years and counted among its members the likes of Socrates, Plato, Plutarch, and Cicero, ceased to exist. Or did it? The priests of Eleusis taught that there was no death, only transformation. It's a question with broader implications as well. Do secret societies ever die, or do they just change into something else? A millennium and a half later, in the late 1800s, the former Confederate general and Masonic scholar Albert Pike claimed that Freemasonry was identical to the ancient mysteries. But he cautioned it was only an imperfect image of their brilliancy, the ruins only of their grandeur. To Pike, the mysteries represented the quest for spiritual enlightenment. Since the mysteries' inception in ancient Egypt, Pike explained, they'd been modified by the habits of different nations among whom they were introduced. Much like a virus, the mysteries mutated and adapted, finding sanctuary within the very faiths that supposedly replaced them. The secret brotherhoods and their sacred missions endured, invisible to all but the initiated. Pike's claims have to be taken with a grain of salt, but he wasn't talking only about the Eleusinian mysteries. The mystery cults, or mystery schools, of the classical world were numerous, intertwining, and overlapping, and above all, secret. Why the mystery? If the knowledge was so important, why not share it with everyone? A Gnostic answer would be because not everyone is prepared for or worthy of such knowledge. It was a way of thinking that underlay most mysteries. Gnosticism, which came in many forms, held that knowledge, not faith, was the key to enlightenment and salvation. Worthiness, in some form, is the basic criteria for membership in every secret society. The fact that it's not for everyone is what makes it, and the people in it, special. But Albert Pike argued that modern secret societies weren't just the Colosseum in ruins. Instead, they were like a medieval Roman palace, built on a foundation laid by the Etruscans, with walls made of stones taken from the palaces of the emperors Augustus and Constantine. In this lecture, we'll explore the organizations and belief systems of the mysteries, and how the stones they left behind provided the building blocks for societies to come. A big problem with understanding mystery cults, or almost anything about the ancient world, is that we really don't have much to go on. In addition to the overall shroud of secrecy, most written records were lost. We're left with scattered bits and pieces to reconstruct entire civilizations. The popular image of ancient Greece and Rome are based more on Hollywood than scholarship. However, it's clear that the mysteries represented something quite different from Greco-Roman civic or state religions. Those were the official observances, such as the worship of the emperor demanded of all citizens. Mystery cults were far more personal. They offered individual mystical experience, even direct contact with the divine, in an atmosphere of fellowship and confidence. The ultimate goals were redemption, salvation, and immortality. Starting to sound familiar? Like the American Albert Pike, the Greeks, those know-it-alls of the ancient world, traced the origin of the mysteries to Egypt. There may have been some truth to that, but no one really knew, and we still don't. In modern times, mystery cults have been linked to prehistoric fertility rites, an Indo-European proto-religion, or even to a sinister brotherhood spawned by Babylonian King Nimrod. But there's not a shred of real evidence for any of it. The late American conspiracy theorist William Cooper argued that roots of the mystery cults lay in a primordial secret society called the Brotherhood of the Snake, the Dragon Society, or the Black Nobility. There's no proof for that, either. Mystery cults did share common features. First, they all had some connection to seasonal progressions like equinoxes and solstices, and to the movements of the planets and stars. Think astrology. Next, they all had initiation ceremonies, often tough and prolonged. These included fasting and ritual purifications. To initiate means to take in. And what one was taken into was a select community. Next, vows of secrecy bound and protected the community. Group rituals, meals, and dancing, the occasional orgy, reinforced these bonds. Mystery cults had a central myth or story that almost always involved themes of death and resurrection. Whether it was to be taken literally or allegorically was part of the mystery. Medieval passion plays have some of these elements. However, cults seldom had written scripture or set dogma. Everything depended on individual experience, which was part of the appeal. The goal was mystical illumination and personal union with God. Let's return to the Eleusinian Mysteries. They started out as a local cult, gradually expanding to Athens, and then later to all of Greece. By the first century AD, they'd reached Rome, and the invisible network of initiates spread throughout the whole empire. The central myth of the cult was the story of the goddess Demeter and her daughter Persephone, or Cori. Demeter was the goddess of fertility and vegetation, especially grain, the staff of life. When Hades, the god of the underworld, carried off Persephone to his dark domain, Demeter fell into mourning, and all growth stopped. Eventually, a deal was made. Persephone spent most of the year on Earth with her mother, but for 3 months she returned to Hades to live with her husband. Thus, the seasons were born. A simple story, but one with layers of hidden meanings, perhaps visible only to the initiated. Despite the veil of secrecy, we know a few things. The mysteries had an internal hierarchy. Ordinary initiates were called mystes. At the top was the Hierophant, the revealer of holy things. Rituals included taking sacred objects from a chest and putting them into a basket. It sounds silly, but the point wasn't the action, but what it symbolized. That's what we and uninitiated don't get. The final revelation was also simple but puzzling, an ear of grain reaped in silence. Christian writers mock this as proof of the cult's silliness. You go through the whole thing just for an ear of grain. But the words were meaningless without the context of initiation. Or maybe it really was just an in-joke. Maybe the big secret is that there's no secret. Since it was common for persons to be initiated into multiple mysteries, the cults inevitably rubbed off on one another, like someone belonging to the Masons, the Elks, and the Oddfellows. The Eleusinian Mysteries, for instance, bore a strong similarity to the more obscure Samothracian cult. Based on the small Aegean island of Samothrace, the cult revered the so-called great gods, whose names were known only to the initiated. At the center of this was a Demeter-like great mother attended by two subordinate male deities. There were sacred objects, and rituals took place both outdoors and in. One theory is that the Samothracian mysteries disguised a cult devoted to the strange goddess Hecate. Among other things, she was closely associated with witchcraft and would survive as a deity revered by European witches. If you know your Shakespeare, you might recognize her as the same Hecate invoked by the three sisters at the beginning of Macbeth. Anyone who's had a geometry or trig class has run into the Pythagorean theorem. But did you know that Pythagoras was the founder of a secret society based on the immortality of the soul, reincarnation, vegetarianism, and naturally, math? The Pythagorean Brotherhood cropped up in southern Italy around 500 BC. Despite its name, it occasionally initiated women. Initiates lived a monastic existence, shared possessions and labor, and were sworn to secrecy. Initiation took 5 years. Pythagoras taught that numbers and numerical ratios were the keys to understanding reality. The real reality, that is. Mathematics, thus, was a mystery. Pythagoras combined this with a belief in an immortal soul that fell from the stars to be imprisoned in an earthly material body. The ultimate goal was to end the cycle of rebirth, escape the prison of flesh, and return to one's celestial home. It all sounds a bit Buddhist, doesn't it? Interestingly, Buddhism appeared just about the same time in India. The Pythagorean Brotherhood also nurtured a murky political agenda. In 5th century Athens, they infiltrated aristocratic secret societies, basically rich boy social clubs, to overthrow the democratic government. Such political intrigue led to the Pythagoreans' persecution and eventual disappearance. It's a pattern we'll see over and over again, a political agenda disguised by mysticism and one secret order using others to achieve its end. The Pythagoreans disappeared, but they weren't destroyed. Their doctrines lived on in other cults. Among these were the Platonists, who appeared a couple of centuries later. Through their founder, Plato, they combined the Eleusinian mysteries with Pythagoras' fallen soul and cycle of rebirth. The Platonists elaborated this by claiming that the soul fell to earth and it was influenced by planetary spheres through which it passed. This notion became part of what we call astrology, and the Platonists went on to inspire the Neoplatonists of the late Roman Empire, who in turn influenced many other cults and societies. Pythagorean influence also shows up in the Orphic Mysteries. Its basic plot line was a takeoff on the Demeter-Persephone myth. Orpheus descended into Hades to retrieve his departed wife, Eurydice. Unfortunately, she turned to look back, and she was trapped forever. It was all an allegory for the Orphic's obsession with the divine soul and its liberation from rebirth and mortal captivity. Sacred music and dance were very important, as were concepts of sin and redemption and ritual purification. The Dionysian Mysteries embraced similar notions with a carnal twist. They believed in spiritual liberation through ecstasy induced through ritual intoxication, orgiastic sex, and acts of spectacular violence. Different strokes for different folks. The cult had an inner society of female initiates called maenads or bacchae. Through dance and drugs, they worked themselves into a frenzied trance that ended with them tearing apart and devouring a consecrated bull, or sometimes a man. Sisterhood is powerful. The first 3 centuries of the AD era were the heyday of the mystery cults, and it's no coincidence that this corresponds to the heyday of the Roman Empire. Rome, by bringing most of the Mediterranean and Near Eastern world under its control, became a melting pot of peoples, religions, and ideas. One of Rome's most popular mystery cults was devoted to the Egyptian goddess Isis. She was another grieving deity who searches to bring her loved one back from the dead. In this case, it's her husband Osiris, the god of the underworld and regeneration. Osiris is murdered by his brother Set, god of violence and destruction, aided by 72 accomplices. Note the number 72. It shows up in a lot of places, like the 72 letters of the Hebrew name of God and the 72 hidden masters who supposedly rule the world. Isis gave birth to a holy child, Horus, who is the son of Osiris and also, somehow, Osiris himself. If you think you've never seen Isis, you almost certainly have. She stares out from almost every image of the Virgin Mary, another grieving goddess. Mary holding Jesus is virtually identical to Isis holding Horus. Or compare Mary mourning over the body of Christ with Isis mourning over the body of Osiris. Mary standing on a crescent is Isis standing on her solar boat. The main festival of the Isis cult was the Navigium Isidis, the Voyage of Isis, held in March. A procession traveled from the temple to the harbor. Elaborately decorated carts carried images of the goddess and other sacred objects. Think Catholic Saints' Day pageants. Participants dressed in elaborate costumes, often mythological figures, and were accompanied by music, dancing, and wholesale revelry. Add bare breasts and strands of beads, and you've got Mardi Gras. At the harbor, offerings were heaped aboard a replica of Isis's holy boat. An egg was broken on the hull for luck, just like champagne bottles. Once cut loose, the boat drifted away, bearing the offerings and prayers. The public procession also echoes the sacred way of the Eleusinian mysteries and Christian pilgrimages like Spain's Camino de Santiago. Similarities to Christian practices don't end there. Isisian sacraments included baptism and the confession and forgiveness of sins. There was even a sacred meal, not unlike the Eucharist. It's a fair question to ask whether the triumphant Christian church abolished the worship of Isis or simply absorbed it. Regardless, Isis was never forgotten. References to her and her mysteries peek out from the 1791 opera The Magic Flute by Freemason Amadeus Mozart. Isis also has some un-Mary-like characteristics. She was credited with control of the stars and the planets and their astrological influence, be it good or ill. She also commanded fate, which meant that by gaining her favor and initiate hacked destiny and attain salvation and eternal life. While the mysteries of Isis were theoretically open to just about anyone, the goddess supposedly chose her followers, not the other way around. She came to them in dreams, and the invitation wasn't to be refused. Much of what we know, or think we know, about the Isisian mysteries comes from a single book, and a novel at that. It's Lucius Apuleius's Metamorphoses, written in the late 2nd century. Apuleius was an initiate of the cult, so while he offers glimpses of the rituals, he's careful never to describe them fully. Apuleius doesn't so much talk about the initiation as its result. The rituals, like baptism, left the participant spiritually transformed. Apuleius just didn't hear stories about the gods. He believed he'd seen and spoken with them. He wasn't promised an afterlife, but shown it. He went to the edge of death and returned. These would all be common ingredients in future secret societies. Apuleius describes watching the sun blazing with brilliant white light at midnight. Was this like the Eleusinian use of awe-inspiring fire? Or another allegory cloaked in layers of symbolic meaning? Of course, somebody else can claim it's a reference to UFOs, much as some insist that the rites of Isis go all the way back to Atlantis. There's also the idea that Metamorphoses is a satire, and we're taking the whole thing too seriously. At bottom, the Icesian rituals were meant to create a new state of mind, illumination. Illumination isn't something learned. It arrives full-born, like Athena, in a flash of revelation, like Paul on the road to Damascus. And the use of mental shock, including terror and physical pain, to induce altered states isn't unique to religious experiences. It's also been employed in everything from enhanced interrogation techniques to psychotherapy. And as we'll see, it plays a key part in initiations and mental conditioning by many secret societies. However, for all their Egyptian trappings, the mysteries of Isis can't be traced to Egypt. Writing back in the 5th century BC, the Greek historian Herodotus mentioned Egyptian mysteries that reenacted the murder of Osiris. That actually sounds like something out of Freemasonry more than it does the Isis cult. Moreover, in ancient Egypt, all rituals were strictly performed by priests. Ordinary people could watch, but never participated. Much the same is true for another popular cult of the Roman Empire, the Mysteries of Mithras. Mithras, or Mithra, was an old Persian god or demigod. Paintings and statues portray him dressed in a Roman fantasy version of Persian attire. And that's pretty much where his connection to Persia begins and ends. Nothing like the Roman Mithras cult was practiced in Persia, or ever had been. The cult popped up during the 1st century AD, nowhere near Persia, but in Italy, and spread from there. It's almost as if Mithraism was invented out of whole cloth. But if so, nobody took credit. The Mithras cult was even more secretive than the Eleusinian or Isis cults. Mithras met in underground temples, or Mithraeums, often constructed in natural caves. The cult left no written records, probably because none were ever written. No Apuleius came along to even hint at its mysteries. Mithraism was mostly, but not exclusively, male. Why, as usual, isn't clear. It was popular among Roman soldiers, who spread the cult to frontier posts along the Rhine and the Danube rivers and to Hadrian's Wall in Britain. About its only visible artifacts today are the representations of Mithras found in its underground temples. The centerpiece, the equivalent of the Christian altar, was called the Tauroctony. Paintings show Mithras always wearing a red tunic and a blue cloak, slaying a bull. Helping him in this, apparent sacrifice, are creatures like a dog, a snake, and a scorpion. And overlooking the scene are what appear to be the sun god and moon goddess. It's all right there in front of us, but we, the uninitiated, don't know what it means. We aren't illuminated. The Mithraists also had a Eucharist-like sacred meal of unleavened bread marked with a cross. That's led some to argue that Mithraism and Christianity were somehow sister religions. History, like the universe, abhors a vacuum, so there's plenty of speculation about the Mithraic mysteries. Some believe the Tauroctony is a coded celestial map. Reinforcing this are the stars emblazoned all over Mithras' flowing blue cloak. One scholar, David Alanzi, claims that the bull represents the constellation Taurus. The dog, the serpent, and the scorpion also correspond to the constellations Canis, Serpens, and Scorpius. In killing the bull, Mithras symbolically progresses time. Thus, the presumed big mystery is the connection between the movement of the stars and the rotation of the seasons. But humans had figured that out ages before. One theory even argues that Mithraism was a kind of star cult. Mithras represented Orion, the mythical hunter and slayer of beasts, whom the ancient Greeks believed had been turned into a constellation by Zeus. Astrological symbolism can also be seen in the Mithraic mystery's 7 grades of initiation, each linked to one of the 7 then known planets. Another common symbol is the crescent moon, or at least what looks like one. So you just know that others read ancient aliens into this. Still others make the case that Mithras, is really the legendary Greek hero Perseus, and the Tauroctony was a stylized version of Perseus slaying the Minotaur. Which begs the question, why didn't they just call him Perseus? There's even an idea that Mithras is somehow Jesus. Mithraic initiates got titles like Raven, Lion, and Persian, and called one another Syndexioi, those united by a handshake. Brethren recognized each other by the signs of the mouth, the hand, and the crescent. The first two were vocal and hand signs, the last maybe an amulet or a ritual scar. Handshakes, hand signs, recognition words, and special jewelry aren't the only similarities to later Masonic practices. Initiates were blindfolded and ritually slain and reborn. The theme of reincarnation also reappears. Mystery cults, like other secret societies, were not created equal. Some appeal to the poor and downtrodden, others to the rich and powerful. Two mystery cults favored by the Roman elite were the Magna Mater, Great Mother, and Sol Invictus, the Inconquerable Sun. We've met the Magna Mater in her Greek guise of Demeter. Originally an Anatolian goddess, the Romans adopted her because she linked them to the Trojans. She was a fertility deity, so, no surprise, her festivals included orgiastic rites. But she demanded that male initiates first castrate themselves. The only substitute was to sacrifice a bull or ram, very costly animals. Thus, the brethren kept their manhood, and the cult kept out the riffraff. Besides, Magna Mater already had a special order of wandering eunuch monks at her command. Magna Mater's self-castrated consort, Attis, spun off his own cult. And he died and rose from the dead, which by now you must have expected. Sol Invictus, the unconquerable sun, was briefly the imperial cult of the late Roman Empire. Sol Invictus was another foreign import, this time from Syria. In 221 AD, the Emperor Elagabalus tried to turn the Sol cult into a universal religion that embraced all the mysteries, even those of the Jews and Christians. He ended up murdered by his Praetorian guards. The confusing part is that Sol Invictus also shows up as a bit player in the Mithraic mysteries. Or he was some kind of alter ego of Mithras. We just don't know. In any case, they share the same birthday, December the 25th, along with you-know-who. I've noted many similarities between mystery cults and Christianity. Not the least is Jesus' crucifixion and resurrection, which fits the long history of holy beings dying and rising from the dead. As in other cults, this was reenacted in the initiate's ritual death and baptismal rebirth. And the bread and wine of the Eucharist, magically transformed into flesh and blood, also has a history in pagan theophagism, or God-eating. Early Christians even called their sacraments mysteries. So, was early Christianity just another mystery cult? Yes and no. Christianity began as a Jewish sect, influenced by Hellenistic culture, including the mysteries. By the end of the first century, however, most Christians were non-Jews, and many were probably past members or one of more mystery cults. The Gospels said nothing about festivals, sacraments, or saints, so they had to be invented or assimilated. Thus, arguably, Isis was transformed into the Virgin Mary. Early Christians also worshipped in secret, like the Mithraists and others. While this was later attributed to persecution, Roman persecution of Christians was mostly sporadic and localized. The Roman Emperor Nero famously blamed the Christians for the Great Fire of 64 AD, largely because nobody knew much about them. But unlike other cults, Christians eventually put their mysteries, like the Mass, on public display. They also openly proselytized, something most others did not. But what really set them apart was Christianity's claim of soul legitimacy and its demand for exclusive loyalty from initiates. Other cults were much more laissez-faire. As the Christian church transformed into a mass religion fueled by mass baptisms, it preserved or recreated aspects of a secret society. First, it obscured its mysteries behind a veil of Latin, a language fewer and fewer Christians understood. It created an inner elite, the ordained priesthood, with a hierarchy going right up to the Pope. And then there were the monastic orders, like the infamous Knights Templar of the Middle Ages. So what have we learned? For one, that the mystery cults weren't just crazy pagans indulging in wild sex and bloodshed. Not entirely, anyway. Rather, in one way or the other, they tackled the big mysteries of life and death. The basic lesson of illumination is that there is a greater world beyond this one. The mysteries also offered reassurance, fellowship, and exclusivity. It's not hard to see how a later critic of Roman Catholicism, the 16th and early 17th century classical scholar Isaac Casaubon, could argue that the church had simply ripped off the pagan mysteries. It's also easy to understand how a 19th century American, like Albert Pike, could see the antecedents of his own secret society, Freemasonry, in the same mysteries. Above all, it's astounding how well these ancient brotherhoods and sisterhoods kept their vows of secrecy. And one has to wonder, are they keeping them still?